returning to our program is Radio Parallax's answer to Frank DeFord, Mr. Sean Mitten. Welcome back, Sean.
That's quite some hype that you always build me up as. I always leave and I think, what a disappointment I must be to these guys.
Capital Public Radio has Frank DeFord, but we have you, and we're sticking with you.
As I understand, however, he gets paid in things other than pizza and beer.
Well, they have a much bigger budget than we do. We may throw in a t-shirt if you're good. Well, you have in your hand there something that was on the newsstands, and probably still is on the newsstands as we go to the airwaves here. A special edition of Sports Illustrated, titled Greatest Feats, Sports Most Unforgettable Accomplishments. And most people out there in our listening audience are on some level, some type of sports fan. And you, of course, had a radio program dealing with the issues in sports in the Pacific Northwest. And I feel you're eminently qualified to address this issue of sports' greatest moments, greatest feats.
Movies, moments, world politics, finance, stocks, bonds, marriage.
Einstein's theory of relativity.
Psychic hotlines. I can pretty much do it all for a small fee.
Sports is not just golf, hockey, football, baseball. I mean, sports in America today includes, you know, mountain biking and, you know, skateboards and mountain climbing. There's a lot that's encompassed in sports. And this collector's edition really focuses in on, I think, things that have owners and stadiums and, you know, large followings.
Now, do you say collector's edition in the hope that you're going to give that book some value so you can slap it on eBay someday, or?
Well, that's the title they gave it.
It's a book.
Collector's edition.
Okay, well, good for the folks that
charge me $10 for it.
See, that's why it's a collector's edition, because you pay $10
They're collecting
for
big
it.
On suckers like me. Well, with an eye to this program, I thought it would make good fodder for what we do here on this program. I don't know. Let me just throw a few out at you. Featured on the cover, we have the Yankee Clipper, Joe DiMaggio, swinging in his famous 1941 streak of 56 straight games that he hit safely in.
Mm-hmm. Never be broken. That streak will never be broken. In fact, I think the closest that anybody ever got, was it Pete Rose? That'll never be broken. I mean, there are certain, there are just certain records that I think will never be broken. That will be one of them. I don't think anybody's ever going to hit 400. In terms of, you know, baseball records, that will never be broken.
Right.
That will stand the test of time.
You know, if you'd ask people, and people did, I remember reading this about 15, 20 years ago, what's the sports record that will not be broken? And people said at that time, Lou Gehrig's record for consecutive games.
Right.
And Cal Ripken, with the determination to play, although he was hurt, I'm sure as Gehrig must have, showing up in the lineup. Isn't that kind of a stupid record?
I think after a while, and even Cal Ripken admitted that about when he was about 75% through that, it really controlled his life. He was not as concerned with contributing to the Orioles as he was making sure the streak was alive. And that doesn't mean he wouldn't slide or dive for a ball if he had to, but it was so consuming to him, and it was so consuming for the team. It literally, you know, he had some of his worst games, worst seasons ever, as he was getting closer and closer to the streak, because it was all consuming and people wanted, you know, every time, every city he went, it's not, you know, how's the team doing? How's the batting average? It's, you're getting one game closer to the streak. How does that feel? How does that feel? And he completely lost focus.
That must have been a dream interview.
Yeah, well, the thing is, he's a great...
Over the 157th time this season.
Well, he's a great guy. And I, you know, when you talk about sports moments, one of the things I will always remember in sports, I was working at a sports station when it happened, is watching him break the streak on ESPN, and they did a marvelous thing. After he broke the streak, Cal pretty much walked around Camden shaking hands and saying hi, and Chris Berman and another analyst was doing the game for ESPN. For about 15 minutes, they didn't say a word. And I mean, I don't get too choked up about too many things, except when I see my stocks tank. And that was really one of those moments where you just kind of went, oh my gosh, you know, you are truly witnessing history.
Yeah.
So the other, you know what, if you want to talk seriously about a streak that will a record that will probably never be broken, when Wilt Chamberlain was with Philadelphia and he scored 100 points in a basketball game, no way. Jordan did 63
yeah,
once.
But weren't they feeding him the ball? Wasn't there in the fourth quarter? Wasn't there a concerted effort to give
yes,
Wilt the ball?
Absolutely.
There had to have been. I mean, I don't know damn thing about basketball.
But he admitted
they
it.
Must
he,
have.
He had like 60 at halftime.
Yeah.
They went in and they said, you know, I think he can get this thing. And you're absolutely right. I mean, they fed him the ball constantly, and that would probably never happen in an NBA game today. But, you know, to be at that point at halftime where you can see that as a realistic goal, that'll never happen again. never happen again.
Yeah,
or if it does, I hope it's well after I die so that nobody tracks me down and says, you said this would never happen.
Wilt was a man for running up big numbers, yeah, apparently.
He had some other numbers that will probably never be broken if you talk to him. Exactly.
Which very few people do.
Do you want to explain what you're talking about?
Yes. I guess when Wilt passed away, I guess, 2 years ago, yeah. A sports legend in basketball. Yes, he published an autobiography sometime in, I guess, the late 90s where he claimed that he had... He had bedded well over, I believe, 10,000 women by actual count.
Yep. Something like, I mean, I don't know the I remember when the book came out and
well,
he
you
was...
started doing the math on 365 days in a year, 3,000 days in a decade, and Wilt was what? It is maybe 60s?
He was a busy man, apparently.
Apparently he was.
But you know, if you're a swinger, you can do 3 or 4 to pop, I would imagine.
I would be... feel very unqualified to comment.
I'm going to have to agree with you there. I don't know what that feeling is. I'm lucky if I got one every 10 years, so I can't comment. But truly, I believe that is a record that will probably never be broken. If Michael Jordan couldn't do it, one of the greatest scorers in the history of the NBA, and he didn't even really come to all that close. I think World Be Free, and that really was his actual name. He actually changed his name to World Be Free.
Right.
He played for the 76ers in the 70s and 80s. He may have had 72 or something at one point. But again, still really not even that close.
Well, you know, this book is full of interesting things. For me, and I remember reading an article, I think it was in Discover Magazine, which was trying to take a scientific view of what are some of the great things that ever happened in sports. And the thing that blew them away was the celebrated jump in 1968 in Mexico City of Bob Beamon, at which point in time no human being had jumped. The record for the long jump was 27-something. 27 what? 27-10? I don't know what it was. 27-something. No one had jumped 28 feet. Beamon goes out and basically adds something like a foot and a half to the world record. He adds 7% to what had been the world record, which by the standards of almost any... When you figure that people are, you know, winning Olympic gold by a hundredth of a second, and this guy goes out and takes the record 7 percentage points beyond... That really impressed him.
Well, that's easily explained. That's explained by the atmosphere in Mexico City and the fact that it's so far above sea level. I mean, you got, you know, that the lack of air, that explains that. I'm more impressed with Mike Powell, the guy who eventually broke his record, because he did it much closer to sea level than Beamon did. It's an amazing feat. It was,
but,
you know,
but others were jumping in Mexico City too, and no one turned in such astonishing, anything remotely like it.
I'm not saying that it's not an amazing feat. I mean, the circumstances have to be absolutely perfect, but that's like saying so-and-so hit X amount of home runs at Coors Field. You know, it's just you have to almost put some type of an asterisk after it and say happened in Mexico City instead of just saying, you know, this is the world record. But Mike Powell, who eventually broke that world record, and of course was jumping with Carl Lewis. You know, Carl Lewis used to get all the attention as the guy who was going to break, he never did. It was Mike Powell, another American, who after breaking the record, he never heard from the guy again. Have you heard of him lately?
No.
But
didn't Carl Lewis actually, he never did achieve, he never did get past Beamon?
Nope, never,
never did.
No, but Mike Powell did. And of course, if you've heard Carl Lewis sing, that's not a very pretty thing either, but that's also probably for another show. The thing about that book, that has a lot of individual accomplishments, you know, Spitz 7 gold medals. And
I was looking at that right now. Local boy makes good. Arden Hills Swim Club right here in Carmichael, California. Mark Spitz went out and won what? He won 2 in 68, and then in 72, he wins 7 Olympic gold medals, all of which I believe were world records.
The amazing thing about that is a lot of times when these people go in and they do something like that, everybody goes, oh my gosh, I can't believe he did that. The expectations that were put on Mark Spitz going into those Olympics was amazing, the amount of pressure he was under and really pulling through.
You know, Spitz is still local, I understand. I wonder if we can get him on the show.
Sure.
Another Sacramento guy here in this Sports Illustrated edition here, a few pages before Mark Spitz, Eric Heiden. Set 5 Olympic records, I guess, in 5 events, 5 gold medals in 1980 Lake Placid.
Yeah, and before that, nobody had a clue about speed skating. And after that, nobody had a clue about speed skating. So, you know, I remember watching that and actually being fairly impressed with that. But, you know, that's one of those, nobody speed skates. I mean, you got to go to like Norway or something like that.
Well, have you seen California. A speed
skate? If you can picture a hockey skate, a speed skate has a blade about, gosh, I don't know, it's like 9 feet long. You know, it's like you're on this huge sled. And it actually, there was a guy from Seattle this year who was doing speed skating, who actually brought a little attention back because he's a good-looking guy and everything. But in terms of the record itself is impressive, ultimately, who cares?
Well,
he doesn't listen to this program, does he?
Dr. Hayden, who is local, right. I believe is an orthopedic surgeon, right. As far as we know, is not a Radio Parallax listener.
Okay.
And I kind of hope it stays that way.
Well, you know, if he wants a piece of me, he can come get some. You know where I am, Eric.
He is the only guy in history to win 5 individual gold medals at a single Olympics. I mean, you're talking about guys like Paavo Nurmi, Jim Thorpe, Jesse Owens.
Sure.
I mean,
Carl Lewis.
And here's Hayden going out there and eclipsing all those guys. That's mm-hmm. really something.
Did you mention it was speed skating?
I'm not a speed skater myself, but I do recognize excellence when I see it.
You know what blows me away is people that devote their lives to... And I understand that the Olympic glory and everything, but biathlons, speed skaters, kayak, you know, you're never going to make any money at this, people. And I understand that the glory is great, but give it up.
Now, wait a minute. What a terrible attitude.
That's
a terrible American attitude. What about the love of the game, the love of the sport, the love of the endeavor?
Where do you pick up a love of speed skating? Where do you say, my God, I want to skate around this pond as fast as I can, but I don't want to hit that pylon, and I certainly don't want to hit the guy next to me, and we have to cross right as soon as we're done with the first lap, and I want to make sure I don't run into the boards.
I don't know.
And I get to wear this skin-tight thing that shows God only knows what. They probably packing bananas down there, but that's neither here nor there. I'm just saying I would never devote my life to something that lame.
Well, I just think, as the famous mountain climber George Mallory said about Everest in the 1920s, you know, why do you do it? Because it's there.
Right. Why do you skate around ice as fast as you can? Because I'm a loser.
I do not share your opinion of the marvelous accomplishments of Dr. Eric Hayden. Here's one I don't mind ragging on just a little bit. Maybe this isn't fair, but the very page before Dr. Hayden, we have another doctor who in 1954, Roger Bannister, an English bloke, went out and broke for the first time the 4-minute mm-hmm. mile. Mm-hmm. But you know, unlike Bob Beamon, this was a matter of very smaller and smaller increments. See, the record was like 4:01, I guess. He shaved a second off of it, which by today's standards is still quite a jump. Mm-hmm. But someone was going to break that record, and it happened to be Bannister. Just because it's a very arbitrary time, 4 minutes. We just, you know.
And I would actually disagree with you on the significance of that, because eventually, you know, now we look at that now with the miles that people are running, but you know, you set the marker. It's like you know, the 2-hour marathon. You know, at one point men weren't running marathons in 2 hours and 5 minutes.
Yeah,
there were marks that had to be broken.
True.
You look at Michael Johnson with the 200 meter running it in 19:03 and things like that. But it all has to start, you know, as cheesy as it sounds, it all has to start somewhere. You have to set the bar someplace.
Yeah.
And at the time, a 4-minute mile was unheard of.
Yeah.
We laugh at it now, but you know, he didn't have the Nikes with the no laces in it and the, you know, the aerodynamic rooms that he could go into to perfect his style. Right. Back then, you just ran your butt off, and again, it may have been a timing thing.
Well, it says in the article that they started thinking about a 4-minute mile when in 1931, a Frenchman, Jules Ladommage or something like that, broke 4:10. That's mm-hmm. when they started realizing, hey, maybe somebody can do it. Mm-hmm. But in all the, and of course, once Bannister did, apparently, my understanding is that afterwards, a lot of people did. That for the longest time, nobody could break 4 minutes. And the second he did break that psychological barrier, people knew it could be done. A lot of people did. His record was eclipsed 46 days later.
That's a great, you know, you just said a great statement, the psychological barrier. That's like breaking 10 seconds in the 100 meter. As soon as you know it's physically and humanly possible to do it, then you break down those walls, and yeah, it doesn't seem nearly as impressive as it did at the time. But at the time, you know, nobody thought that could be done, and someone stepped forward and did it. And then at that point, you know, you open the floodgates.
Now, one anecdote I remember a lot about Dr. Bannister, he was a 26-year-old medical student at the time that he broke the record, was that I just love this story. He came over to do a TV show, like I think it was like who I've got a secret or what's my line in one of these things. And it was going to be, he was going to be the secret guest. And before, you know, satellite TV, they might not have known what he looked like so well. So he maybe had a chance of pulling it off. He apparently got off the airplane, was walking along, and someone came up. I remember the person that told the story that they asked him a very brief interview about what he was doing here. And somehow it came up as, who's the sponsor for the show, by the way? Is it a cigarette company? And they said, yes, it is. He said, oh, I absolutely will not appear on a program sponsored by a cigarette company. And he turned around and basically got back on the plane, I guess, and flew back. Just absolutely flat turned him down. I will not help promote cigarettes. I've always admired that about Roger Bannister.
Wouldn't see that these days, probably, because those people are getting paid big bucks to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, like Joe Montana, I'm going to Disneyland. Remember when he did that?
Where'd that come from? That's in fact, last year they had two different guys do it because they didn't know who was going to be the MVP of the Super Bowl, so they had a couple of different guys doing that line. So don't even get me started on that crap.
I think I would like to get you started on that crap, but not today.
The thing about that book is it's showing individual accomplishments. And if you're talking about memorable moments, I think more in terms of a team concept, of a team that, like the 69 Mets or the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team, you know, a team that nobody thought was going to do something significant, and miracle of all miracles. And I think, honestly, the most impressive thing I've ever seen is probably when the United States beat the USSR in the 1980 Olympics. That was only the semifinals. What a lot of people don't realize is they had to beat a pretty good team. Gosh, you know, I think it was Finland or one of those Norwegian teams. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like the gold medal was in their pocket after that game. They still had to go out play another good game. Mm. So, and what people don't realize is the Russian national team at the time was being paid to be a team, even though it was just still supposedly an amateur sport in 1980 before, you know, we decided to let all the best basketball players and baseball players and everybody in. It still technically was amateurs at that time, which makes it, you know, these guys were college players. They were IHL players, AHL players. They didn't have any NHL players at that time. And for them to go out and do what they did with the expectations that were put on them, which were zilch, to me, that still stands out as probably the most inspirational and memorable single moment in sports history for me. Even though I was in elementary school or junior high when it happened, I still very vividly remember it. And of course, Al Michaels' great line, "Do you believe in miracles?" You're hemming and hawing like you don't think that's a great moment.
I just the whole idea of all these professional teams going to go for Olympic gold just rubs me the wrong way. We were very angry back in the 70s when we knew the Soviet bloc was cheating like unbelievably. Like all of a sudden, all the East German swimming team all looked like Lou Ferrigno as the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah, and the East German women
with deep voices all of a sudden.
Yeah, yeah. You know, they're shaving their mustaches every day. The women are, and you know, I agree.
And, well, but they were all using steroids and just flat out cheating for the sake of Olympic gold,
which makes that moment even more impressive when you consider the Russians are being paid. They played as a team for years and years and years. And basically, what Herb Brooks did, he was the coach of the University of Minnesota hockey team at the time. He took a bunch of guys together who had never played together, had maybe a month, maybe 8 weeks to get these guys ready. And they went in, gelled as a unit very quickly, and they ended up winning the gold medal. Yeah. To me, that is, it's not only impressive, but it was really inspirational. You got to remember the times, too. And remember what was happening in 1980. I mean, it was not the best of times with the things that were going on over in Iran and the things going on in this country. It really motivated and picked up this country. I don't know where you were, but it helped me out.
Well, you know, one thing that isn't mentioned at all in the Sports Illustrated greatest feats are a lot of things that aren't, you know, like I say, supported by stadiums and teams and big business, sort of individual accomplishments, which are also in the realm of sport. One guy that always strikes me as a guy who's just never really talked about in America is this guy, Reinhold Messner, who has gone out and climbed every peak in the world over like 25,000 feet. He's climbed all, I guess there's like the 8,000 meter. There's like 16 peaks in the world. He's climbed them all, I believe, without oxygen. He's climbed Everest solo. It's like this guy is he's an animal. He's not human. And yet he's not very well known in America.
I've never heard of this man.
There's proof positive.
But again, you know, you're mountain climbing. What is that? That's just a bunch of rich people who go around the world because they can afford to do that, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, I couldn't go to the Himalayas right now. I couldn't afford a Sherpa. I don't have that kind of money. It's rich. It's for rich people.
$60,000 to go. These chumps are paying guys to run them up and down Everest right now, like John Krakauer.
Which is a joke because it's not even a challenge anymore. You can go the easy way.
You can hire a Sherpa to basically rope you.
And drag your ass up.
And drag you up.
In fact, there's a great Simpsons where they do that exact thing to Homer Simpson as he's climbing Mount Springfield. But again, we'll save that for another time too.
Oh, maybe it's time to end this one on a high. Are we on a high? I hope we're on a high. We're on Everest. You know, it doesn't get much higher.
Higher than Everest.
29,028 feet or whatever. All right. Well, thanks again, Sean.
You're welcome.
Evolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction,